I think it was about a month ago, I got to MC a benefit, a fundraising benefit, for the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. It was a benefit called Vicious, and it was really quite an evening. Now, I've been to the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art before in the past. They always do really interesting exhibitions. And this benefit, this party, was just an incredible event to raise money for this the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. Now, I got to meet the executive director, Christian Anderson. Seemed like an interesting fellow to me, but we didn't really have much of a chance to talk. Just met him in passing, kind of in a meeting before the benefit, and then we chatted a little bit at the benefit, which is just basically a big party, a big, you know, a big gala party with a lot of great food and entertainment. And then, you know, there was an auction and all of that. And but I just kept saying to myself, this seems like an interesting guy, this Christian Anderson. And so I decided, well, let's get him on the Let's Go Eat show. He's more than an interesting guy. He's really an intellect. I was just pretty much blown away by the intellectual capabilities of this guy as we chatted about what it means to be the director of a museum or well, it's a museum. It's not an art gallery. It's a museum. The Utah Museum, UMOCA is what everybody calls it that knows about it. If you've never been there, you're missing out. It's free. I bet you don't even know where it is, do you? You don't know where UMOCA is, the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. Well, you listen to this episode of the Let's Go Eat show, you're going to find out where it is, what they do, but you're going to find out what contemporary art is going on right here in Salt Lake and, well, what contemporary art is going on in Utah. You know, my only regret with this interview is that during the course of the interview, Christian mentions that he used to be a performer. And I meant to ask him in the interview, what kind of performing did you do before you became a museum director? And as it turns out, he used to be a street performer. He used to do apparently juggling and magic and fire eating and all of that kind of stuff, and traveled all around the country doing that. And I didn't ask him about it. And I regret that, because maybe we'll do a whole show about Christian Anderson and his street performing days and his. But for now, we're just going to talk about the Museum of Contemporary Art and contemporary art and what that all means here in Utah. So here it is, the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, and it's the Let's Go Eat show. I'm Bill Allred. And enjoy. You know, I just wanted to come back at the tail end of this just real quickly and say, I said enjoy at the very end of that, and I hate that. I'm sorry I said it, because I really don't like it when waiters and waitresses, when they bring you your food at the table and they set it down and they go, here you go, there you go, and they say enjoy, like you're supposed to enjoy. You know, I hope you enjoy this interview, but it's certainly not required. I think you'll enjoy it, but you don't have to enjoy it. So anyway, again, here's Christian Anderson, the executive director of the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. Enjoy it or don't. Christian Anderson, executive director of UMOCA, which is what everybody calls it.
Yep, it's not just a tasty coffee beverage. It's also a museum of contemporary art.
It does sound like a tasty coffee beverage, doesn't it, UMOCA?
It absolutely does. Like, you know, sort of an après-ski kind of thing, yeah. You know?
Yeah. I'll have a cup of UMOCA, please. Mm. It almost sounds like one of those decaffeinated beverages that the LDS folk like. You know, Puro and... Anyway, it's the Let's Go Eat show, and we're here with Christian Anderson in the Cafe at 50 West, where we often have the Let's Go Eat show these days, because it's a place where you can go eat, and it's convenient for us because it's right downstairs from our studios where we do Radio from Hell.
I was telling Jonathan, the guy who runs the cafe, that them opening this so close has made us lazy.
Yeah. We used to go out more to restaurants around in the area, and we'll get back to that, but it is late. You know, I'm working upstairs, and I go, we can just go downstairs and record the show.
Yeah,
you've never been here.
So. I've never been here. It's perfect for me. You know, it's about three blocks, and of course, Salt Lake City blocks are basically six times a normal city block. So, you know, I got a good walk down.
Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, located, maybe a lot of people don't know, right by Symphony Hall.
Mm-hmm. Right next door, just to the east.
How long has it been there?
Well, that building, the building that we're currently in, opened in 1979. So it was built as part of the bicentennial build-out of the Salt Palace. And so I think they broke ground in 77, opened in 79.
And was it always meant to be what it is?
Yep, it was built as then the Salt Lake Art Center. And, of course, the Salt Lake Art Center, we changed our name to the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art several years ago. But 2016, and I want to say it's February... Early February of 2016 will be our 85th anniversary as an organization. So,
really?
Yes, sir.
So now you, but you're new to the place, right?
A year and a half.
No. Mm-hmm. So 85 years ago, somebody started the Utah Arts Center.
Correct.
And what? And where was it then?
Is it Reservoir Park? Is that South Temple?
You were up in Finch. Yeah,
where Finch Lane is. So that was built as the original home of the Salt Lake Art Center. So that building was built as an art center. And then we were there for many years until we moved to our new building. So we've sort of only had two homes, really.
The Finch Lane Gallery. And I think they still maybe do occasionally little art shows up at Finch Lane,
yep.
too, don't they?
Yeah,
it
they
seems
do them.
To me I went to somewhere.
Yeah, they do them all the time. It's now the home of the Salt Lake City Arts Council.
Ah.
So the city's folks that bring, you know, Twilight concerts and such things are up there now. And you know, Finch Lane Gallery is up there, and they're open all the time with exhibitions.
Yeah.
Part of the city's effort to support local arts and artists.
Whose idea was the Utah Art Center, which became the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art.
Salt Lake Art Center, but yeah.
Salt Lake Art Center. Was it always designed to be a contemporary art venue?
I don't know that you would say that it was designed to be a contemporary art venue in the way that we are an exhibition space.
Mm-hmm.
It was definitely designed initially to be a community art center that both displayed current work and did lessons. You know, we still do photography lessons at UMOCA, the Salt Lake Art Center Photography School is still there. But they used to do a lot more painting classes and
watercolor classes,
yeah,
and all of that.
Ceramics.
Yeah.
So it was founded by a LDS woman named Alta Jensen. And in the late 20s and early 30s, she looked to put Salt Lake City on the cultural map. And one of their first exhibitions was an exhibition of nudes, actually. And so...
Really?
Yeah, there was a bit of a backlash, and she made a very impassioned speech that said, you know, what does Salt Lake City want to be? Does it want to forever sort of be a cultural backwater, or does it want to be a place that is in the national discussion for what's going on in the arts? And this was a pious LDS lady back in 1931. And so she really sort of planted the flag on the fact that artistic expression in the visual arts is something that should be central to Salt Lake City and Utah.
What was her name?
Alta Jensen.
Alta Jensen.
Alta Jensen.
There should be a statue of her.
There really should be a statue.
It's just very abstract, and you don't know it because it's contemporary. I'll leave you guess what it is.
It's a nude somewhere, but you wouldn't even know it's a nude.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to figure it out through this whole conversation, but I want to know what it takes to start an art museum. Does somebody with a lot of art have to die and give it all to somebody who starts it?
And what's the difference between an art museum and an art gallery?
Now we're getting into some questions of really parsing language.
Yeah.
So
we're hard-hitting here.
You're hard-hitting. Well, yeah. I mean, the fundamental thing about my organization, whether you would call it a museum or a gallery, so we are not a collecting institution. So if you look at my friends and colleagues up at the UMFA, you know, they are very much a collecting institution. They're always looking to add work that expands their mission of presenting an encyclopedic history of art
That's the Utah. Excuse me.
Sorry, UMFA, Utah Museum of Fine Arts, up at the university,
okay.
With special emphasis on arts of the West and Intermountain West, naturally, because that's where they are. So for us, we don't collect. We are more of a Kunsthalle by mission, which is a place that just displays work without a collection. We do have a little bit of a historic legacy collection. Being an 85-year-old institution, people die or bequeath art, and there are some works there, but that isn't fundamentally key to our mission. So in that way, we differ from what you might think of as a traditional museum versus a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that puts us more in realm with our museum friends is we are a 501c3. We are and always have been a not-for-profit institution. We're free of charge to go into. Whereas when I think of galleries, there can certainly be nonprofit galleries, I think.
Most of them.
Yeah, exactly. But so we're a tax-exempt organization. And, you know, given our size, we're a lot more like a museum, too. You know, we're tens of thousands of square feet versus if you go to a commercial gallery like the Phillips Gallery or whatever it happens to be, where selling is part of their key mission. You know, it's just a lot of it has to do with mission differentiation.
A gallery is basically where an artist, not necessarily a living artist, but an artist will display his or her work for sale.
Usually.
Yeah, and then the gallery takes a commission on anything that is sold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Correct.
Usually. You can't usually walk in a museum and make an offer on...
No.
Give you $50 million for the Mona Lisa or whatever.
That would be considered pretty gauche.
Yeah, and I don't think it would get you too terribly far.
No.
Yeah.
You know a lot, and I want to talk more about the history of UMOCA. You obviously did your homework. You've only been there a year and a half. How many directors has it had?
Oh, you know? Man. In its totality, I have no idea. 1, 2, 3, 4. I've met at least 4 of the ex-directors. I would say in the last 15 years, it's probably had about 4 or 5 directors. Rick Collier was there for many years. I don't even remember if it was 10, 12, 15, mm-hmm. quite a while. Then there was a director named Heather Farrell who was there for probably not quite a year. Adam Price was there for about 3 years. Maggie Willis was an interim director for a year until I came.
So you've done homework. You found the history. You've studied it. Did you do that before you got here?
To a certain extent, absolutely. I mean, in an 85-year organization, when you're coming for a job interview, you certainly have to know and acknowledge the history of an organization and realize its impact. I moved here from Seattle, and Seattle to Salt Lake City, there's also a lot of the culture is a little bit different. So there was a lot of cultural homework, seeing how our organization and its mission fit into not only the Salt Lake City metro area, but it is the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. So once you change that what was the Salt Lake Art Center to the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, what is the tacit agreement that you have with the general public to represent all of the arts in Utah, like what's going on in Carbon County, what's going on up in Logan. You know, those are the sort of things that if you are the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, you nominally have to care about. I mean, when you run a nonprofit, you sort of exist in the public trust. And in fact, the Attorney General is the person that really has oversight fundamentally over all nonprofits because we are public trust institutions.
So let's talk about Christian Anderson then, your background and how you come to this job and how you come to this line of work. Where did you grow up? And
I was born on a cold, windy, snowy day, which is actually true, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, in a town called Iron Mountain, which has had one stoplight at the time. I think they're up to 2 or 3. I heard that they got a McDonald's next to the Shopko, but... you know, I haven't been back in a couple of years.
Still have family up there?
I have cousins up there, but when I was pretty young, we moved to Minneapolis. So really, I grew up for the first 25, 30 years of my life in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Mm-hmm. Went to the University of Minnesota as an undergrad. Started out, failed out, had some wacky adventures, then came back and ended up getting degrees in ancient Greek and Mesopotamian art and archaeology and history.
Well, really useful stuff.
Really useful stuff. I became a house painter when I graduated.
Yeah, why that? Why? What fascinated you about Mesopotamia and ancient Greece? And
well, you know, I had always really enjoyed history as a kid, and I started out as a history major, and I had to take elective credits. And as I'm sure anyone who's been through college can tell you, you have to take elective credits. And I figured that archaeology would be a good dovetail in history, that you're studying a lot of the same things. And so really I was looking for an easy credit that I didn't have to put too much effort into and would get a decent grade. But rapidly I found out that my brain actually works better in object-based thinking, which is much more key to sort of archaeology. I mean, I really love text-based history, but thinking in objects, images, and artifacts is sort of the way that my brain worked. I really enjoyed classical archaeology because... you know, I would love to say that it's Indiana Jones, and maybe that's part of it, but there's something to be said when you're on excavation. You get to pull up, like, a whole statue, and it's got writing. I've also done Native American archaeology, and I have great respect for my friends who do Native American archaeology, but you're pulling up tiny potsherds that look like bark, and I don't know. There's just something inherently sexier to me to be able to just go dig up an ancient Greek city.
So, yeah, right. There's only so much you can... So many times you can dig up an arrowhead and be really excited about it.
Yeah, and so it was a pure decision of I thought that that was a more interesting way to go. And the way that this sort of is relevant and dovetailing to where I am today is for my archaeological fieldwork, I ended up in Cyprus, and not a lot of Americans have... Cyprus isn't really high on a lot of American radars.
It's an island, right?
It's an island, yep. Just south of Turkey, and this is sort of what comes to play. We were supposed to go dig a Greek city in Israel, but the second Intifada happened and they were shelling, so they wouldn't let American students go. So we ended up in Cyprus. But Cyprus is a divided island, and there's a demilitarized zone that cuts the island in half that's patrolled by the UN. And so you have a Turkish northern Cyprus and a Greek southern Cyprus. The Greek side is independent, but they're Greek-speaking and Greek culture. And what was interesting to me is I was digging up artifacts that were 2,500 years old, but because it was a divided island and there was very much political tension between the north and the south, I was fascinated to see how their museums really used these artifacts as cultural weapons to say, like, I was in the Greek side to say, like, Greece is good and Turkey is bad.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that's purely anachronistic. I mean, 2,500 years ago, these sort of cultural divisions didn't exist.
Yeah.
So it was fascinating to see this contemporary overlay on these older things to really hammer home a particular political point, which when I came back to the United States, I was really, really interested in museums as places that shape cultural identity, are sort of can get involved in the culture wars, and what is our the concept of neutrality. You know, I'm a person that sort of believes that there's no such thing as neutral. You know, organizations have a point of view, and you're better off to articulate and admit that point of view and move forward than to try to pretend that there's something called neutrality. So I was really, really fascinated by museums as agents of cultural change and cultural dissemination. So I went and got my master's degree in museum studies at the University of Colorado. And when I got there, I just happened to be in the right place in the right time, and having done some nonprofit museum work where they had a small gallery whose director had left. And so while I was getting my master's degree, I was able to run this gallery, and that was a contemporary art gallery. And so I actually discovered that working in the contemporary art field, the questions that I was interested in with museums as these agents of cultural change, I could have those dialogues directly with artists and really be reacting directly to society and cultures around me, and be sort of reflexive, but also help to sort of push the needle a little bit on social issues that I was passionate about. So
rather than study how art in the past had changed culture or had responded to the culture around it, you could see it, how it worked, you know, living.
Correct.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I found it much more satisfying to be engaged in contemporary dialogue rather than, you know, working in things that were 2,500 years old. I mean, I still love that, but to me it's just more engaging and meaningful. And now I've been in the contemporary art world longer than I was in the classical art world, so I've been doing this for over a decade now. So
So you start working in this contemporary gallery, you get your degree, and you decide this is what I'm going to do as a, I mean, it's a pretty rarefied, pretty specialized area to say I'm going to be a contemporary art guy. I want to direct contemporary art museums.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty specialized, but I mean, if it's something that you love and that you're passionate about, you'll find the job and opportunity. I ended up going to the University of Washington to do my PhD work in contemporary art theory through their art history program. I never finished it, but I ended up being a gallery director in Seattle for, I don't know, 6.5 years or something to that effect. Before, you know, some time happened, and then I ended up out here. So, I talk to a lot of students, and I go into a lot of undergraduate classes, and they want me to talk about internships and career development. And I've had a very circuitous path. And I've been very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. And I hear that a lot, but I've also been done the front end work of volunteering and interning when I was early on in my mm-hmm. career, being present at gallery strolls, being present at events, to when those opportunities came that I had the both people knew who I was and I also had enough of a skill set to bring to bear. So it's a little of column A and a little column B.
It's I think it's interesting. And Dylan, would you mind
getting you some water?
Well, I also ordered some black coffee, which they never.
Yeah, I can go track that down.
And I don't want to. You know, we don't ever stop the interview. And as I do an aside here, asking you to go get the black coffee, I'm also affording our guest a chance to eat a little bit of his hummus and pita here. Mm-hmm. And is there anything you need?
No, I'm doing good. Yeah. Thank you for the pita bite break.
Sure,
ooh, that's a hard one to say.
Yeah. So speaking of it being kind of I wouldn't think there are a lot of jobs that in this field available. I mean, are there a lot of opportunities to be a director, an executive director of a contemporary art museum?
I would think not. I haven't done a full survey of how many of my colleagues are out there. You know, 50 to 100, I suppose. If you are not in a New York or a Los Angeles, certainly most cities probably wouldn't have multiple organizations that have a person like me. Colleges and universities are always a way to go. You mm-hmm. know, their galleries, although if they're tying back into the pedagogical needs of the university, they will have an encyclopedic bent because you're teaching ancient Greek art and you're teaching all this sort of stuff. But colleges and universities are always also, you know, tend to be forward-thinking institutions depending on the college and university. And so usually they're often pushing a contemporary art program in parallel with a historical art program.
Mm-hmm.
So,
let's talk about what the job entails. What do you do? You know, must be certain requirements that you have to do, but there are things that you never dreamed you would have to do.
I think being the executive director of any organization, and especially a nonprofit, there are certain similarities. Certainly, you know, I am the direct liaison to the board, so our board of trustees helps set forth policies and visions, and I have a large hand in shaping that because, you know, this is what I am trained to do. And so then we also have budget issues, financial things, human resources stuff, checking in with all of the departments of the museum and supporting their efforts too. So a lot of what I do is very administrative things that aren't terribly exciting, but just go with being an executive director of any organization. That being said, I get to do a lot of studio visits with artists, and I absolutely love that. I get a chance to go.
What does that mean? I mean,
in a studio visit, I'm going to either an artist is going to reach out to me, and if artists are listening, never hesitate to reach out to a museum to come and look at your work. The worst thing they would do is say no, and I always try to say yes as best I can. So an artist will reach out to me, or I might see their work online or somewhere, and I want to go talk to them, learn more about what it is they do. Because usually if I'm seeing their work in passing, maybe I'm seeing one or two works. It might not be representative of the entire body of what it is that they've done. So I like to go down, spend a half an hour to an hour, really see what it is that they are creating as a maker, and then really understand why they are creating it and have a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they want feedback, and I will try to give them as honest an opinion as I can, realizing that in my line of work, a lot of times I think there aren't any right answers, but sometimes there are wrong answers. So I try to be as honest as possible. Oftentimes they'll ask me for help with a proposal for something they're submitting, read over their artist statement, and then figure out how, you know, if there's a spot for them in an upcoming exhibition at the museum that makes sense thematically. It's really sitting down with the people who make the work that I am privileged to work with all the time and really see what they're doing.
That's a kind of a position that to me would carry a lot of responsibility, talking to artists and kind of trying to curate and mm-hmm. talk to them about what they do. And some of them, I'm sure, are mature artists that this is what I do, and
sure.
this is, you know, and they're secure in what they do. But I think a lot of times you probably talk to artists who are, what do you think? And am I going the right way? And you know,
yeah, and I think that you know, I've lived in several major metropolitan areas now, and I actually think that there's a lot more similarities in terms of the culture in Utah and Minnesota than there was between Utah and Seattle, for instance. I think that that those of us who live here, we're pretty nice and we're pretty polite, and it's not in most people's general DNA to be like, well, actually, you know, what you just did is pretty horrible. Like, that's one of the worst things that I've ever seen. Yeah. So you need to be able to give feedback to people. And you know, if I've seen somebody do a work that I saw another artist do in Seattle or that I know an artist in New York is doing, you know, I can't really say, like, wow, I think that's incredibly derivative or somebody else has done this better. I'm like, you know, why don't you take a look at this artist, see what they're doing and how this is in, and sort of more gently sort of instruct them. Yeah.
Oh, crap, somebody's already doing this.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to say to somebody just, yeah, I really think you should go get your real estate license because...
You wouldn't do that.
No, I don't know that it... You never know someone's potential, right? So even if I'm going into a studio visit, there are people whose work I'm seeing at this point that I would probably not champion. That being said, if I can say something and say, you know, your technique, you know, I really think you should work on this type of thing, a year or two from now, you know, they might be discouraged and never come back to it and be like, that Christian Anderson is a total asshole and da-da-da. And so it might either encourage them to get better, they might stop. I don't think I ever want to be the one that says you should never do this. I might be the one that says you need to work harder on this particular technique and then come back to me. But I mean, who am I to say what someone should be doing with their
Well, let me ask you that. Who are you to do that? And I ask you that from the standpoint of so you've looked at a lot of work in Seattle over a goodly period of time. Minneapolis has a pretty good art scene. You've had experience in New York looking at art. you have been in the art world a long time now. First of all, can you give me a fair assessment of yourself as someone who can assess art and an art critic?
I think that, wow, you're asking me to be very self-reflexive here. So there's a couple different worlds, art worlds. So I have never been, I will say straight up front, I've never been in the commercial art world. I've always been in the nonprofit side and always in galleries that didn't have selling as their occupation. We were working with artists who might be dealing with something thematic or pushing a social issue or whatever it happened to be. And so the mission of the artist and the expressiveness of the art without thinking about a commercial consideration have always been first and foremost in my mind. And that's more so where my skill lies. I can look at something and I certainly can recognize technique. Like I know if someone has the ability to paint well, and this has nothing to do with what they paint in terms of the subject matter of the painting itself. But I've been in this industry long enough that I can see good technique for bronze casting. I can see good technique in sculpture, in ceramics, in photography, in painting. So there's a construction side of the making of an object that I feel qualified to assess.
Okay.
And then there's a thematic side in discussing with artists that I feel very qualified to speak on and to address. But then there's that whole commercial arm, and that's sort of talking with what you said earlier. People are always obsessed with the value of things in museums. Like, what's the Mona Lisa worth? And it's fascinating because we don't particularly think that way. We have insurance coverage, but that's not what I think on. So that's a whole world that I am not at all qualified to weigh in on.
The commercial success or lack thereof.
Yeah, or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. That's just nothing that I've ever waded into.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with that answer. I think that's a really good self-assessment. That's an excellent self-assessment. And I asked that question to preface this question. Mm-hmm. How then do you, what do you think of the art scene as you've been here for a year and a half? How do you assess the art scene in Salt Lake and in Utah in general?
So Utah has a history, and I don't think that this is not a bad thing. Even as the director of a contemporary art museum, I think people think when I say this that I'm being critical, and I'm not. We have a long history here of really, really good landscape painting, both in oils and watercolors, figurative sculpture, portraiture, things that fall under sort, and even actually people, I've seen people do beautiful still lifes that live in this state. People that work in sort of very traditional painting, photography, and sculptural themes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an incredible strength of what it is that we produce here. Contemporary art, realizing that we're only a metro area of, 1.2, 1.3 million. How many people are in the state of Utah? 4 or 5 million? There's not a lot of people over a lot of space. And I think that we are, between what we're doing at UMOCA, what Quack is doing, the fact that you have a contemporary art curator up at the UMFA, believe it or not, what Jeff Lamson's doing down at BYU, what they're doing up in Logan at the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum. I think that there are people, and actually in the Kimball, there are people, I can think of six organizations right off the top of my head, that while contemporary art might not be their sole focus, with the exception of us and Quack, that they have people that are...
Quack.
Oh, Quack. Sorry. Quack, it used to stand for the Central Utah Art Center, and it was down in Ephraim. And then they, about 2 years ago now, I think they moved up to Salt Lake City. So now Quack just sort of, I think, stands for Quack. And they're on it's CUAC, not to be confused with the Queer Aquatic group, which is also Quack.
Right.
So they're on 2nd East and 2nd South, and so they are also a only contemporary art venue.
Okay.
And so thinking about the fact that in a metro area of this size that I can name six people or organizations that are dedicating, if not 100% of their resources, some of their resources to promoting contemporary art, I think that's fantastic. I do think, and this is something that I have seen in every city that basically isn't New York and Los Angeles, I think everybody suffers from a certain level of second city syndrome that I find frustrating. And I don't think that that's just true in visual arts. I think that that's true if you start looking at politics, government, and maybe not for film, because film is, this is kind of the epicenter for, that's not Los Angeles, right? I mean, we have a really, really robust film program here in Utah. But everyone's comparing themselves to what's going on in Los Angeles.
Are you saying that there's an inferiority complex?
Correct. Yeah. And I find that to be not particularly productive. I think if you are always comparing yourselves to New York or Los Angeles, cities of 9 million people with long-established, huge cultural programs, philanthropic communities, and much more government support, you're going to perpetually be frustrated. And I think that there's a lot of stuff to celebrate here. That being said, I also see, with that second city syndrome and inferiority complex, sometimes people are unwilling to be critical because there's this concept of what a scene needs, whatever that scene is, whether it's the food scene or the visual art scene or whatever, needs nurturing. We don't want to squelch something in its early sense. And I think that sometimes when you, with the best of intentions, you try to nurture things, there are times when stuff just isn't that great. And so it's sort of that two-edged sword of being a growing metro area that is outside of the giant spheres of Los Angeles and New York. But again, it was the same thing in Seattle. It was the same thing in Minneapolis. This is not something that is unique to Utah, but it is something that Utah also has in its DNA.
Yeah. Another great answer. I'm impressed with these answers because I think, you're exactly what I would want as somebody to curate a museum and to curate art and to because you have to look at these things critically and understand the DNA that goes into it.
And it's a tough balance. Like I was previously saying, I'm not going to tell somebody that they're such a bad artist that they should go get their real estate license. But at the same time, how do you balance critique and constructive criticism that helps both an artist and an art scene grow, with at the same time not just giving people platitudes and telling them they're great and continuing down a path of mediocrity. I mean, anytime any organization in any industry, nonprofit or not, wants to be taken seriously, There has to be some self-reflectivity. There has to be constructive criticism. You have to make mistakes, and from those mistakes, you have to grow. But you have to acknowledge those mistakes. You can't just pretend that they didn't happen. That's how you build a stronger organization, city, state, culture. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, I've kind of always thought there's something about Salt Lake that bugs me, and kind of recently I've been thinking along that. Like, I think your observation about the art scene is just very true overall of, like, Salt Lake City. And I think it's kind of like a second city syndrome of really a group of people, a city really, really wanting to be like Seattle and the next step up in
Portland,
the tier of cities.
Yeah, Portland
or something like that, maybe even Denver, and like just like really getting close to that, like we're getting there, but not quite there. But they're kind of like walking around, like,
well,
you know, bitter about it. Or
you want to see. He grew up in Ogden, and I grew up in Ogden. You want to talk about a city that has an inferiority complex? You know, it's just
no
like,
way. No.
We're just Ogden.
Yeah, that's very different. That's very different than Salt Lake saying, we're just like Denver.
Yeah.
Whereas Ogden people,
well, we're
a little bit ashamed of themselves.
Yeah.
They're able to critique each other. They know, like, what, okay,
we don't deserve nice things.
We need to work on this.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Well, we don't deserve
Salt Lake
nice
doesn't
things.
Say that.
You know, you're only a couple years from being the statistical Ogden-Salt Lake City Provo Metroplex.
Right.
Which,
yeah.
I mean, it's already kind of there
yeah.
in terms of looking at development up and down the Wasatch Front. And what do each of these, entities bring to the discussion?
Let's go back to what Christian Anderson does as executive director of UMOCA. So he visits artists. Who decides and how are the decisions made about what shows to bring into the museum?
So I have a curator of exhibitions, and her name is Rebecca Maxim. And so she is the person that is charged with setting the curatorial agenda for things that happen inside of UMOCA's walls. I have a curator of public engagement and education, Jared Stephenson, and he is principally tasked with thinking about UMOCA's partnerships outside of the walls and when we do, you know, community-based art engagements. And then there's myself, who, you know, weighs in from time to time. So really, Becca's the one that sets the tone for things inside. Although Jared will curate an exhibition from time to time, I'll curate an exhibition from time to time. And so we really have, if you figure there's three of us on our curatorial team, mm-hmm. We all sort of lend our expertise and thoughts. But really, it's Becca's final call for things that go on inside.
How is it done? I mean, how do you decide? How there are certain. What did you just roll?
I sort of did the finger around the table because it's a lot like this. You know, we'll be having lunch or we'll be having a meeting, and someone will spark an interesting nugget of conversation that we want to explore. Our main gallery exhibition that just came down, Panopticon. Becca did a fantastic job on it. That came out of a conversation where we were talking about, you know, the NSA data site out at Bluffdale, and Pete Ashdown, who is the founder of X Mission, is a friend of ours, and thinking about Google Fiber coming into town. And so sort of sitting around and talking about these current events and then saying, if we are the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, let's think about things that are salient to Utah and our contemporary conversations, and let's tackle those through artistic exploration. So Panopticon was born, which was this exhibition that was all about net neutrality, data mining, internet surveillance, which I think resonates in Utah on a lot of different levels, and not only just Utah, but it's a huge contemporary conversation about where we want our society to go. So really, it just sort of breaks out of conversation of people sitting around and talking, and then saying, "Hey, let's tackle this."
So you set that as the what do you call it, the theme?
Yeah,
for a show.
Sure, theme. Yeah.
So then, where do you find the work that goes into making up that show?
Becca spends a lot of time doing research. So, you know, as you're in the industry, you develop a network of connections and colleagues nationally and internationally, so you might send out an email to them. We go to art fairs and exhibitions out of state. So Art Basel in Miami, Jared and Beck and myself all went down there last December. So we're going to...
That's a huge art.
It's the largest in the United States. It's massive. And so we go down and we look at artists and take a lot of notes and look at a lot of art in 3 or 4 days. And so we see people that we might not have known there. And then you know, God bless the internet, speaking of the internet, mm-hmm. in terms of what it does for being able to do research today that you didn't have those same tools, you know, 20 years ago, when we were all working on slides and you'd have to call a gallery and say, send me some slides of this, and everyone would be looking at her slides. So, but she spends a lot of time doing research and figuring out which artists would fit best with a theme and why. And anytime you're designing an exhibition, which is why I every day I'm so impressed with what Becca and Jared do, is you're building a jigsaw puzzle. Like, let's say you're building a 50-piece jigsaw puzzle, and you want it to look like something when you're done, but the 50 pieces that you're using come from 50 different sets. And so you're trying to make a whole out of all of these disparate things. And you have to honor the individual artist. So you have to honor their artistic intent and highlight and educate what they do. But at the same time, you have to overlay that with sort of a curatorial voice as to, you know, why are you selecting these 10 or 20 artists? Because otherwise you could just select 10 or 20 random artists. You know, the curatorial vision is what holds the whole thing together. So there's a lot of research and a lot of different sort of tensions at play. And I think that there's a lot more that goes into the curator's job than people think, as much as it is eating wine and or drinking wine and eating fancy cheese at parties. That's only a small percentage.
So then somebody has to figure out how to hang all those things or display them in a way that's pleasing and makes sense and is thematically and all of that.
Yeah, so Becca will lay out the exhibitions, or Jared or myself, depending on who's curating any exhibition. So that's the curator will lay it out. And then there's an entire career path called preparator, and preparators are the people that are interested in getting whatever the art is on the wall, building the plinths, getting, if it's a digital work, getting all of that up. So they're the ones that are sort of manifest the hanging and the execution. But the planning and stuff is usually done by the curator.
So when you call for entries, mm-hmm. I guess that's what you would say it is, you call for entries to these shows, or you contact artists?
Either way, depending on the exhibition.
And you contact them and say, we would really like to display your work for this show we're doing, and you explain it to them. Sometimes they say, no, I'm not, no, I would assume. Or do they almost always say, oh, we'd love to send you our piece?
Almost always they say they would love to send the piece, with the exception, usually it's, if it doesn't work out, it's usually scheduling conflicts. Mm-hmm. Very, very rarely in the art world, scheduling or money, you know, one of the two. Very rarely does someone get an opportunity and not want to take it, especially at a museum.
So the opportunity to have your piece shown is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a great. So then, what's the money?
So, you know, we have we have budgets for every exhibition, and out of that budget will have to come shipping, wall vinyl, marketing materials, food for a reception. So thinking about what the cost to actualize an exhibition is, there are solid costs there. At UMOCA, we like to make sure that every artist involved gets some sort of artist stipend. It's never as much as I would like to give people, but realizing that artists work hard and deserve to get paid for their production, and it's not just... it's not just us saying this is good exposure. You know, I came from Minnesota and I was a performer once upon a time, and people would always want me to do a show and they'd be like, this is good exposure. I'm sure you've gotten this.
Oh yeah.
And I always used to say, this is Minnesota. People die from exposure, you know, and really wanting to at least acknowledge them with something that we are paying for their creative endeavor.
Kerry, my partner on the radio, and I forget who he gets this quote from. It's never do anything you're good at for free.
Oh, that's the Joker from Batman.
Oh, the Joker from Batman.
Yeah.
Never do anything you're good at for free. Heath Ledger, yeah.
If you're good at something, never do it for free. That's what he says.
Mm-hmm. So the artist gets some sort of a bit of money for the work and the exposure. And I guess that
sometimes people might even buy something, even though it's yours is not a gallery,
sure,
which is designated to sell things.
But. Yeah, if you really like an artist's work that you see at UMOCA, thanks to the internet, you can look them up and you can figure out who either their dealer is or how to contact them. And then, you know, that transaction would happen away from
UMOCA. Probably happens.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Yeah. I'm sure it does. Yeah. So, and that's great. I mean, that's one of the positive things for artists coming out of that is they do get people to see their work.
How many shows, Panopticon, mm-hmm. that there was another one or two installations at the same time, right?
Yeah, we have five different gallery spaces. So Panopticon was in our main gallery. Our second largest gallery is the Street Gallery, which was named because it was on street level once upon a time. So there you go. And so for that one, so the main gallery exhibition is going to feature national and international artists. It's just a larger scale. Street Gallery is going to be sort of local to national artists. It might be a single artist show. We have the Doctoral Prize for Contemporary Painting that is coming up in September that will be in there. So that's just one artist that will be in there for a couple months. And then David Brothers is going to be doing an exhibition of his work starting next February. So.
Has he done anything?
Not in a long time. I think he was in a two-person show up at Finch Lane many, many years ago. But it's been 15 to 20 years since he displayed his stuff. So I'm really, really excited to get his work into the gallery.
That's
He's working
great.
With Becca.
Did you have a hard time talking him into it?
No, not after you and I were on set together. We were in the pictures together.
Yeah, in the rubber room, Trent Harris, the rubber room.
Hmm. Yeah. So I mean, and David comes to the museum quite often, and so I was able to chat with him, and so it's been fantastic getting to see his process, his photographs, and for lack of a better word, his puppets and his sets, and mm-hmm. so I think that's a good example of us being able to take an artist that does tremendous things locally that nobody really knows. I mean, sure. If you're in a small community, you know who he is, but there's a person that does amazing work that really needs to be out there in the public mm-hmm. eye. We have the Projects Gallery, which is specifically for artists living and working in Utah. We have the Codec Gallery, and that it's really a black box. It's meant more for video works. Mm-hmm. And then last but not least, we have what's called the Airspace, which is a gallery that's dedicated to show the work of our artists in residence. We have a comprehensive 1-year-long artist in residence program where there are 6 residents at any given time. And so part of their residency, not only are they getting help with artist statements and all of that, but they have to do an exhibition in the museum as part of their residency.
It's a lot of stuff in a year.
It's about 22 to 25 exhibitions a year, depending on how the calendar falls. And that doesn't include things outside the museum or public programs. So.
How many, you know, this is, in a way, I think of this as a sort of a gem in the community that that probably not enough people really know about. I would think that a lot of people who come to UMOCA stumble across it. They're downtown, they're tourists mm-hmm. downtown, and they see the sign and they go, oh, well, let's go in there. And it's free.
It's free.
To go in. I mean, you can leave a donation. There's a box.
And, yeah, we try to stiff arm you into getting $5, but, yeah. you know, it works to varying degrees of success.
Yeah. But I think there, and I don't mean to make it sound insulting, but I think there are probably a lot of people who just have no idea that it's there.
Absolutely. I think that our location is great for some things and disadvantageous for others. When you look at the way it's sort of even the trees have grown up on those boulevards with the, I think they're sun locusts or honey locusts or whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. A lot of our curb presence is sort of blocked, and it's architecturally we blend very well into the Salt Palace and Abravanel Hall. So I think that there would be a lot of opportunities. I mean, if you could work with signage and zoning and all of those sort of stuff to differentiate our building from the Salt Palace and Abravanel Hall.
Will they let you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Until I have the money to do it, it has been a moot conversation.
Could you have David Brothers do something to?
I probably could. You know, I come a little bit from the school of it's better to ask forgiveness than permission, which especially when you're new to town, you know, you can get away with that pretty well.
I didn't know.
You know, I didn't know. Now that I've been here a year and a half, I'm starting to move past that grace period, I think. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, sometimes you just, you know, sometimes you just.
I didn't know I couldn't cut down those locust
trees.
Why is it, though, that, you know, like a city like New York City with 8 million people or Paris, like you have museums in these cities that are just a part of the culture with every member.
Well, you just said it. You just said it because they're a part of the culture.
Well, how do they become that? How does that work? How do they become a part of a culture? I don't get it.
Because they have culture.
Yeah. If we saw this today at this table, man, I'm buying you 100 lunches.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that there's also a level, trying to be honest and reflexive, there's a little bit of time. You know, Salt Lake City is nowhere near as old. Like, if you're looking at a place like New York.
Sure.
Or if you're looking at a place like London or Paris,
But 85 years, the museum's been open.
Yeah, and which, for a business or a nonprofit, 85 years is pretty darn good. Mm-hmm. You know, all things considered, if you look at the failure rate of businesses, nonprofits aren't as high. But, that's a lot to trumpet. And the fact that this community has kept it going for 85 years is great. And I never go into work on any day thinking that the community, the city, the county, the state, or our visit, no one owes the museum anything. You know, we have to constantly work to show people why their dollars as a nonprofit are being well spent. I sort of joke. When you get into this business, you do a lot of development and fundraising, and I certainly have met plenty of people who are wealth managers, or they take straw and spin it into gold, and I always joke that I take gold and spin it back into straw for you. I think once you start feeling entitled, or once you start feeling that you're irreplaceable, you're on the rapid slope to being replaced.
Yeah.
And so I never want to go into any day thinking that people owe me anything. But I do think it takes time. And I've only been here a year and a half. But in my time that I've been here, I hear a lot of people say, like, man, this place has changed so much in 5 years. And boy, the Olympics sure pushed us forward. And boy, and I think it's hard to, we're very much in a bubble of what's right in front of us. And time has this weird thing where what's happening now is very present. And then it sort of compresses or expands as it moves away from us. And so it's hard to have what does 15 years really look like? What does 5 years really look like when, we're in an election year and a lot of people are talking about what's Salt Lake City going to look like 5, 10, 20 years from now? Well, what does that look like boots on the ground when it looks like, where we were 20 years ago? That's a tough thing for us to wrap our minds around.
Yeah, I would agree. What is the operating budget?
$777,306.
Not quite a million.
Yeah, three quarters of a million.
You're getting a lot. You're getting a lot out of that money.
Oh yeah. I don't know if your listeners particularly care about this, but for me, we ended our last fiscal year in the black, which was for the first time in a long, long time. And so, trying to do what it is that we do and provide, engaging contemporary exhibitions while being fiscally responsible is a challenge, and I'm really, really proud of what we've done. And that's an entire team effort. That's my curators creating amazing things and doing it while being budget savvy. That's my marketing director finding all sorts of partnerships that we can do and ways to get the word out as best we can on limited funds. That's my development team, working the phones and the interwebs and all of that sort of stuff. And my board supporting me. And so I think that there's a lot to be excited for there. And I do think that I see the potential for strategic growth. I think nonprofits, not even just nonprofits, all of us, if we start believing our press too much, run the risk of trying to expand too quickly in a non-sustainable way. And as an executive director of a nonprofit, the thing that's most important to me is protecting my employees and their families and making sure that they can pay their rents and mortgages. If someone has volunteered to work in the nonprofit sector, they have made a conscious decision to make less than they would in the private sector. And so we need to realize that was a choice. And if anything else, really be cognizant of the people that have volunteered to, again, put their houses and families on the line for our nonprofit mission. So I really want to see good, conscientious, strategic growth that is sustainable.
And there is a lot of community outreach at UMOCA. You have something called the Art truck?
Yeah, the art truck. We just got a brand new one, actually. Well, it's a brand new used one. A new used one. It's new to us. It's about 10 feet smaller, and it's got a better engine and better suspension, and so we're going to be able to get all the way to all the corners of Utah. Our poor old art truck wasn't so happy trying to get up to like Park City and up the mountains and whatnot. So we pick an artist that is our art truck artist for the year. We like it if we can wrap it into core curriculum standards. We go to a lot of schools, fairs, and festivals. And so we bring the contemporary art programming to the students. And for a lot of people who are in free and reduced lunch districts where that's a high percentage of the population, that might be the only arts programming they get. You know, I think that I understand why our leaders have gone with STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. As a way to sort of jumpstart critical occupations. But at the same time, there's an inherent and intrinsic value to arts education, what it does for making you be a critical thinker and problem solver and cultural consumer that can't, that is irreplaceable. And so for us to go out and sort of provide some of these students with the only arts exposure they have is an important thing.
And you do go to all over the state?
We're going to be able to now. You know, we were doing broader programs several years ago, and as our art truck has gotten more and more decrepit, we've sort of stayed in the, what did I say, Provo to Ogden Metroplex, just because I was really afraid that our truck would break down. But now with the new truck, we are St. George, here we come.
And where does most of that $700 budget come from?
So from a bunch of people, our single largest funder is actually, it's you guys. It comes from the ZAP tax, which for those of you who don't know is Zoo Arts and Parks, and it's a 0.1% sales tax of everything in Salt Lake County. And so we are a tier one organization. That was me knocking on wood because we have to reapply every year. But ZAP is our single largest funder. And the nice thing about ZAP is it goes to general operating funds. As a person, you know, when you're fundraising, targeted funds are the easiest thing to get, and especially education. There's a lot of different foundations and organizations and people that are willing to give to education, exhibitions. But trying to find unencumbered money that people will let you use to buy toilet paper or whatever it happens to be. Pay the lights. It's significantly less sexy, so it's harder to do. So that's the great thing about ZAP. You know, we have corporations in town that have philanthropically stepped up, Zions Bank, Wells Fargo, X Mission, Epic Brewing. I'm sure without the wall in front of me that there are some Wasatch Advisors. I feel like once I start down this list, I feel like I have to be comprehensive or I'm leaving somebody off. And then, of course, there's foundational support, too, from both national and local philanthropic foundations that fill in. And then you start getting into individual donors and members.
So, and then you do fundraisers.
Yeah, we do fundraisers. So it's a broad spectrum.
What's coming up at UMOCA? You're closed as we are recording this. You're closed,
but we'll reopen on Friday. So before this even comes out,
okay,
we will be back up and running. So let's see.
And that it's closed for no other reason other than they're just putting in some new shows and.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no problems.
We just because
giant cockroaches. They're carrying away the art.
See, I was going to say something about outdoor retailers, but that has nothing to do with giant cockroaches. No, outdoor retailers comes twice a year, and so basically we mesh our deinstall reinstall schedule to coincide with OR because OR is. OR is hard for.
It's just hard to find a place to park downtown and
exactly. So the main thing to remember is the last Friday in August, is that the 28th, I believe?
I think it is, yeah.
So August 28th, basically the entire museum is going to be having a shindig to reopen the museum. Exhibitions will be open starting this Friday, so we will be open to the public again this week. But in terms of marking your calendars to come down and celebrate five amazing exhibitions, that's the night to do it. We're open from 7 to 9. There'll be refreshments. There'll be a bar. All of the things that people like, some fantastic art, and the first time to see some of these works.
Okay. When is that the David Brothers show?
No, David Brothers isn't until February.
In February.
Yeah.
Okay. Gary Vlasic is doing a big deal.
Gary Vlasic is doing an exhibition called Mall, which is really sort of looking at what the concept of purchasing things and where the consumer and the maker sort of meet when you used to have brick and mortar and now you're moving more and more into the internet, and even in terms of digital fabrication in that way. So really looking at the way that people purchase and are consumers, you know, at the same time working with makers that make very sort of one-off and crafted things. And so that exhibition will open on this Friday. So that will be open by the time your listeners hear this, that will be open.
Okay. So performance art very often down there?
We do have performance art from time to time. It isn't scheduled in on a regular basis. I've noticed we've been partnering with a lot of our local contemporary dance companies, interestingly. So people have been coming down. And it seems like we're doing about 3 or 4 partnerships with our local contemporary dance companies a year. People coming in and using the artwork in the space as sort of the jumping off point for a dance performance. So,
I think we've got it.
Got it?
Yeah. Anything we need to add that you can think of?
I don't know.
We're about at our hour, so.
Yeah. How are you doing? How's Radio From Hell?
Good.
How many years have you been doing that? 85 yet?
No, not quite. People ask me that all the time, and then I have to ask Richie, our producer. How many years?
About 35.
It's, no. Well, I've been doing radio since 1980.
Yeah.
Carrie and I have been doing radio since 1986.
There you go. So your 30th anniversary will coincide with our 85th anniversary.
You'll do a big deal with that?
Yeah, we're going to do a 85 for 85 celebration, and that will we're going to be kicking that off before too long, and that hopefully will culminate next February in around the same time that we do the opening for David Brothers and that sort of stuff. We'll be able to sort of launch that because that will right around David Brothers' show will be the exact day of our 85th anniversary.
Cool.
Well, long live contemporary art.
Yeah.
Here, here.
And as it becomes fine art.
Yeah, it goes into being historical. And, yeah, contemporary is always moving, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Christian Anderson, it's a pleasure. Anything I can do, just let me know.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right. That's it. The Let's Go Eat show. Christian Anderson, director of the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, UMOCA. Thanks to Dylan for producing the show. Thanks to the Cafe at 50 West for the French fries and the pita and the hummus and everything else we had. Thanks to Mike and John who run the place. And I guess that's it. Just remember, if you're pouring drinks, always make mine a double.